Several months ago, we witnessed on television the newly appointed Pope. He was coming out on the balcony at the Vatican to greet an audience, according to what they said on ABC, NBC, and CBS News, of 1 million people in the square at the Vatican. 1 million people. And they were aroused, they were enthused, they were shouting and clapping. It was quite an interesting show. Television crews from all around the world were also recording the event with Pope Francis as well as American networks were. And they said literally there were many millions of people tuned in to that particular event. The fervor and the zeal of millions of people around the world, as well as the demonstrations of this zeal for this religious leader in Brazil, where 2 million people met on the beach to receive a blessing. The fervor for that should tell us something about the prophecies to be fulfilled. I'd like to share with you today, as we head to the Feast of Trumpets, as we begin to look at some areas of prophecy on trumpets and, of course, the Day of Atonement and going into the Feast of Tabernacles, I would like to examine what is about to occur in the religious world with the great deception, with the great deception. I'd like to discuss with you, in fact, that is the title of the sermon today, The Great Deception. I'd like you to turn, if you would, with me to the book of Revelation. We're going to take a lot of scriptures today. We're going to carry you through a number of the scriptures, but I'd like to begin by asking you to turn to Revelation, the 11th chapter, and we are going to begin in verse 1. Who would have believed? Who would have believed that in our day, this day, going back probably 20 years or so, that the Berlin Wall would have crumbled and we would have one Germany? Who would have believed that all of the satellite buffer states of the great Russian Empire, like Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, would be on their own at this time in the history of the world? Who would have believed that the Baltic states would be free to follow their own dictates? Who would have believed that the KGB and the Communist Party would be systematically dismantled? It boggles the mind. It's just something that we as Americans in fighting the Cold War over the years just simply find it almost impossible to believe. But who would have believed that for a period of time the only great superpower in the world would exist, and that would be the United States? Yes? Who would have believed? How about the fact that that superpower, the United States of America, would have a terrorist attack on its own land? Who would have believed that? And yet, there's something even more incredible that is about to be bequeathed upon the world that we live in. It has to do with some of the events that occurred at that balcony and the Vatican Square down below. It had to do with what happened over in Brazil. It had to do with many, many nations around the world watching and seeing with great fervor what was going on in that part of the world. So what I'd like to do today, I'd like to tell you a story that you may not believe now. You may not believe it now, but I hope that someday you will. And I hope you will understand why it is so important for us to understand these things. Because the Bible is very explicit about, if it were possible, even the very elect would be deceived. So let's ask the question, what kind of world will Jesus Christ come back to? What kind of world? Well, you're here in Revelation, the 11th chapter, and I want to begin in verse 15 in this particular case. And it said, then the seventh angel sounded. Of course, that is the seventh trump, and it is the time of Christ's return. And it said there were loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and His Christ, and He shall reign forever and ever. Verse 18, and the nations were angry, and your wrath is come, and the time of the dead that they should be judged, that you should reward your servants, the prophets and the saints, those who fear your name, both small and great, and should destroy those who destroy the earth. What is the answer to what kind of world Jesus Christ is going to come back to? A hostile a truculent and angry world, a people who will fight Christ at his return, according to Revelation, the 19th chapter, which we'll go to in a few moments. But why? Why? I believe that the answer to that is a part of what is unfolding now in the world that we live in. Secondly, let's ask a second question. Why will the beast and false prophet be cast into the lake of fire instead of simply being destroyed? When the angels will come and they will pick up these two men and they will literally at that particular time cast them into the lake of fire. Because according to Revelation 19 and verse 20, verse 20 simply tells us these two men would be taken immediately and thrown into that lake. Why is the society in this condition? How did it get that way? Why must these two men be dealt with in this way? Listen closely, because I think it has an awful lot to do with you and I not being deceived. How does the devil know? How did the devil know about the plan of God? Well, if you stop and think about it, he spent aeons of time as the anointed covering cherub that covered the throne of God. He was up at that particular place in the third heaven. He was involved in listening to and watching the planning and the strategies of God in the Father and Jesus Christ in the third heaven. Secondly, he has to know God's general plan. Thirdly, he knows the scriptures. For example, he quoted scriptures in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, and he misquoted scriptures time and time again. And so we recognize that this spirit being has been at work in the minds of evil men. He's been at work in the minds of deluded men throughout all of the ages. From the very beginning, when he took Adam and Eve down a road of deception, to the very day that we live in today, to the very day we're going to talk about in just a little bit, we begin to understand his whole purpose is to thwart the plan of God. Why? Well, the simple statement, according to Revelation 12 and verse 12, that he's angry. It tells us that in the last 3.5 years before Christ returns, according to Revelation 12, he tells us there, or God tells us there, that Satan is angry because he has but just a short time. Now, we have to also understand that he has used for thousands of years the oldest religion in the world. He used Mystery Babylon with its roots in Nimrod and Semiramis. And he will use it again under the guise of a church that has all the trappings and all of the background that has come from Nimrod and Semiramis. We will begin to understand that this universal church will perpetrate upon the world his will to a deceived group of individuals. Let's think about some scriptures. You don't need to turn them. Just listen to them at this part of the sermon. Daniel, the 11th chapter in verse 45, says that he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and, of course, in the glorious holy mountain. He will put his tents of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet it says, he shall come to his end. 1963, through the early period of 1964, the Vatican purchased property in the Holy Land for the purpose of building a palace. And they said it was for the purpose of future visits by the hierarchy of the church, and especially the person who is their leader. In Daniel 7, verses 24 and 25, we read the following words. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, and he will persecute the saints, and he will intend to change times and laws, and it will be given to him for a period of a time, times, that's 2.5 times, for 3.5 years. So we begin to understand something is going to occur. Now, Revelation 13, let's turn there this time, and let's read parts of Revelation 13 and evaluate what it is saying here as we follow the parallel to the other scriptures. This is Revelation 13, beginning in verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. This particular beast absorbed all of the others. And so what we see here is what we'd simply describe as the final resurrection of an empire that is going to control the world for a period of time. It had seven heads and it had 10 horns, and one of his horns had 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name called the Holy Roman Empire. Now the leopard which you saw, the beast which you saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and his authority. Verse 5. And he was given a mouth to speak great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Now we look at this scripture in chapter 13, and we see 42 months, yet in another place you see time, times, and half a time, but again the same period seems to be indicated in both places. So as we look at this, we recognize that we have what we describe as a beast or a military power. It is the military power of the final resurrection of a Roman Empire that God said would have finally 10 kings that would be with this particular beast and the false prophet for a period of time. Notice verse 11. And I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had 2 horns, like a lamb, that is, he was religious, and he spoke like a dragon, which means also that he had the power of the first beast when it came to civil and ecclesiastical abilities. Notice what it says in verse 12. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those that dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. 476, the Roman Empire was driven down. 554, there was a resurrection under Justinian of that particular empire. All simple things to understand from history, which we, of course, have the chart that we have in the church. Verse 14, and he deceives those that dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, which simply means the rejuvenation of the Roman Empire with 2 men, one called the beast and one called the false prophet. And we begin to realize that he causes many as who would not worship the image to be killed. So we recognize again a martyrdom that the Bible talks about in several other places. We'll save that for a little bit later. But we see there was a military power, the beast. We saw there was a religious power who would be a religious individual who had hold sway over the world in a most unique way. We see that he had power over men, deception through miracles, monetary and governmental control, then governed by a deceptive system. So let's this afternoon deal with some things that are fact. Let's deal this afternoon with some probability thinking. Let's also talk a little bit this afternoon about possibility thinking. All three of those. Remember, we're looking at what we describe as fact. We're thinking about possibility thinking, and then we have probability thinking. So let's evaluate that for just a moment and look at what we see at the time of the end and how what you saw happening on that balcony, what you saw happening in Brazil, what you saw happening in other parts of the world is only a precursor to what's going to happen in the world that we're going to live into. Let's notice over in Revelation chapter 11. Let's turn back one or two pages to Revelation chapter 11, and we begin to read about something very interesting. It tells us here, then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood saying, rise and measure the temple of God, the altar and those that worship there. So we see something that is created, something that is being used called the temple, an altar, and those that worship there. Verse 2, it says, leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles. Now you begin to understand that you have two different groups that are talked about here. And it goes on to say, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. Exactly the same thing that is found in Revelation 13. The same numbering that is found over in the book of Daniel. 3.5 years. And we see here in chapter 11 and verse 2, that they would have this power, not in this temple or whatever this may be, but outside of it, outside this particular area, as he calls it, the court or that area outside the temple itself. Verse 3, and I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days. Guess what? Another 3.5-year period. Another time and half a time. And here we see in this case it's saying 1,260 days. So we see in all of these places this same event that's beginning to come together as a particular group. And it says in verse 4, these are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. Now, let's stop for just a moment and evaluate this. Two witnesses in Jerusalem. It says they measure the temple. It says that they prophesy for 3.5 years. So what do we have to look at? We have to look at some possible physical structure that is there. How do we know that? Because Daniel 12 and verse 11 says there would be sacrifices that would be given. They would allow to sacrifice for a period of time. And Daniel 12 and verse 11 says the sacrifices would be taken away unto the time of the abomination of desolation, 1,290 days, or shall we say 3.5 years plus 30 days. Now, we're not going to play with all these numbers all through the sermon. That's not my purpose in the sermon. I'm taking you down a little different direction. But the point is that we see here in chapter 11 and verse 1 that two witnesses are there. A temple or a possible structure has been set up in some way for the Jews to sacrifice for a period of time. The Jews are allowed to have these sacrifices because the king of the south is permitting it to be so for a short period of time. Now, there are two theories about this Temple Mount, so that you should know. We are told that some people believe that the Dome of the Rock, that is held by a totally different religion that is not part of what we call Judeo-Christianity and that sort of thing, but that particular group of people, that rock supposedly by some people is going to be destroyed. It's called the Dome of the Rock. But then there is an interesting theory that people don't pay attention to. The Jews don't tell you about this. But if you go back to March, April of 1983, there was a very interesting article from A.S. Kaufman in the March, April Biblical Archaeology Review. The question was where the ancient temple of Jerusalem really stood. And Mr. Kaufman proved in this particular article that the actual temple area where the holiest of all was located in a place called the Dome of the Tablets. The Dome of the Tablets, which is located a number of yards away from the Dome of the Rock. Now, this particular Dome of the Tablets, and he proves this in his article, and I have talked with literally dozens of people in that part of the world, and they have said, yes, his research is good. So it means that you could have two different religions abiding in that particular area for a period of time. Now, it's interesting to note that when you read what the people of the Turkish period said, they sealed up the one wall called the Golden Gate because they were told that the Messiah was going to come back through that Golden Gate. And so they decided they'll keep him from getting in. They'll just seal up that gate. And I thought that's most interesting to understand the lack of understanding about the powerful being that Jesus Christ is. But they said that he would land on the Mount of Olives and he would make a straight line down through the Golden Gate and come to his temple or the place where, you know, the holiest of all was. It was interesting that when I was there in 1983, I stood right in the Dome of the Tablets, right on the inside of it, and I looked straight up, all the way up to the Mount of Olives. It was a straight line. It wasn't crooked or bent. It was a straight line. And I said, wow, maybe Mr. Kaufman has it right. And maybe the Jews really do know. And I found that most interesting. Now, what are we looking at here in chapter 11? Are we looking at the fact that possibly God protects this area by the two witnesses and that he keeps this beast and false prophet from getting into this particular temple for a period of time? Is it possible that these men in their 1260 days or 3.5 years have the ability to do all kinds of things until they're finally killed? Because when you begin to look at the rest of the chapter, you look at verse 7. They have, of course, the power to shut the heavens, as verse 6 says, though no rain falls. They have power over water to turn them to blood, to strike the earth with all kinds of plagues as often as they desire. Verse 7, when they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit, interesting. When it ascends out of the bottomless pit, meaning it was hidden until that time, we see then will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them, and their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, where our Lord was crucified. They're going to kill them in Jerusalem. That's what it means. They're going to be killed in Jerusalem. Now, what happens is they're going to begin to rejoice and they're going to be extremely happy because the rest of the world can see this. It says in verse 9, those people from the tribes and tongues and nations will see their dead bodies. How are they going to do that? We call it worldwide television, folks. We saw it happening when the Pope was standing on the balcony when millions and millions of people got to watch him. And this is what you see as you begin to look at verse 9. And they dwelt together and rejoiced over them because these two prophets which tormented them by performing all these miracles were now killed. Verse 11, now after 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered them and they stood on their feet and great fear fell on those who saw them. So we see something very interesting here. We see that something occurred in Jerusalem. We don't have very much information, but we recognize that you can have two places coexisting for a period of time. But why the difficulties for these two men? Because they had power given by God. Now, I want to take you to a place over in 2 Timothy chapter 3. I want to show you a possible speculative thing. I hope you'll understand that what I'm doing right here is to give you a speculative thing. But there's a very interesting scripture found in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 8. This is not found anywhere else in the entire Bible, but two men are mentioned here in verse 8, and they are men that came from the Old Testament period of time. It talks about the problems at the time of the end. It talks about the latter days being perilous times. So we see the whole concept is something happening at the time of the end. But notice verse 7, always learning, never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, so do these resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds disapprove concerning the faith. There's a parallel that Paul was trying to show us. The parallel was between what Moses and Aaron did with these two men called Jannes and Jambres, and he's trying to show us at the time of the end that we have a problem with simply defections and deceptions that will occur. They will culminate in one man. We're going to see that in a moment. It will culminate in one man that says that he is God. Now, let's stop for a moment and look at this. Jannes and Jambres are two interesting characters. One, apparently it's Jannes, is a king ruler. The other is Jambres, and he is a religious priest magician. Okay, look at the fact. One is government, one is religion. Now go back and look at Moses. Moses was government, Aaron was religion. So you had two fighting against two. See my point? What are we going to have at the time of the end? Two fighting against two? I think you have to say something is occurring. Exactly how it happens, you can't put your finger on everything. But it's interesting we find a biblical parallel in history. Moses and Aaron, Jannes and Jambres. And we see that each of these four men held a position. Now, let's look at Exodus and the plagues for just a moment. The snakes. Both sides produce the ability to have snakes. But what happened? Aaron's rod swallowed up the snake on Pharaoh's side. Secondly, you had the rivers, waters and blood. They were done by both, but they were greater by Moses and Aaron. Now, I don't know about you, but when you're in a battle with somebody and you keep losing, and you keep having this fight going on, you begin to get more and more frustrated. And of course, you got Pharaoh standing there watching this whole shooting match going on here. And you begin to ask the question, okay, what are these two guys capable of doing, and what are Moses and Aaron capable of doing? Now we come to frogs. That was done by both, but again, greater by Moses and Aaron. Then we came to the fourth one. It was lice. The magicians could not, and they said they could not, and they said, this is the finger of God. Ah, what happened then? At that time, Pharaoh hardened his heart after they said, this is the finger of God. Then God severed the land of Goshen from Egypt for their protection. So now we begin to see that when you take this Jannes and Jambres and Moses and Aaron and you bring them to the time of the end, you see that you have two witnesses. You see that you have two men also who are the beast and the false prophet. They're going to meet somewhere. They're going to meet somewhere. So let's take a look at that for a moment in Matthew 24 and verse 15. Here again is another prophecy, and it has more than one possible aspect to it. This is Matthew 24. Matthew 24. And beginning in verse 15. Matthew 24, verse 15. It says, therefore, when you see the abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So we see that there's going to be something called an abomination of desolation, or an abomination in the holy place. Okay, let's look at three possible aspects of this. One, we recognize, according to Luke 21 and verse 20, that armies will surround Jerusalem, and this is referred to as desolation. It referred to as something occurring as an abomination of desolation. Secondly, there is something in the holy place, possibly a statue. I don't know. Is it possible that they will put in there a statue of somebody who was a former saint or former minister who was dead that they had a replica of? I don't know. But you have to think about that possibility. But the third one is true. Third one is true. And that is a certain person. A certain person. A religious person. Somebody who's going to say who he is, and he's going to have power to carry out some of those things. Now, if you look at the abomination of desolation here, as verse 15 says, you simply see it could take place in stages within a 3.5-year period of time. And we see sacrifices having been stopped, and now you have this abomination, and we begin to understand something unique may be occurring at this particular time. We ask a question here. What does the Catholic Church believe about the return of Christ? What do they believe about the Antichrist? Do you know? I can tell you. I have before me, in this particular sermon, I have a piece of a paper, or what I call a magazine, entitled Prophecy for Today. It is by Edward Connor. It was written back in the middle to late 50s. It is probably almost something that you can't get a hold of anymore. I, by chance of a friend, found a copy back about 8 or 10 years ago. But this particular book we're going to see in a moment has some very interesting statements by saints. Now, saints in the church then, and saints to them now, are people who are dead. They are not saints that are alive. As the Apostle Paul said, we are called saints. You read that in about four or five different places. But what we see here is something in the writings of the Catholic Church. They believe Christ comes first and Antichrist second. Now, I think we can prove that by reason of some of their writings out of this particular section and by reason of several other places. The history of the Council of Trent tells you some information. The Catholic Encyclopedia tells you some information. The Anti-Nicene Fathers tell you some information. And Prophecy for Today tells you that. I'm going to send you to where you can get it for yourself and show you what they say. And then you can check me out when you look at those particular sections of these different magazines. And I hopefully will be able to do that in the time that I have left in the sermon. So we see then they believe Christ comes first and Antichrist comes second. We believe Antichrist comes first and Christ comes second. Based on what? 2 Thessalonians 2. So let's go there. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. We read a statement here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning in verse 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and beginning in verse 3. The Apostle Paul makes the following statement. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. Falling away from what? Falling away from what? We're going to get an answer right in the context, okay? They're going to fall away from, first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Verse 4, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Somewhere on this earth, right before Christ returns, a man has to sit in a place called, as it says here, the temple, and he has to say, I am God. Now, how can he do that? Because a world has to become deceived. A world has to become subject to some of the things that they will bring forward. Okay? Now, dropping down to verse 7. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so till he's taken out of the way. The Apostle Paul may be the one that's spoken of back in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. But the principle before this individual does his dirty work at the time of the end, that somebody has to resist him. I say to you, it's the two witnesses. I say to you that they are the ones that make his life miserable until they're killed. And when they are killed, and when this individual and the beast are given that ability, they have signed themselves a problem. Because they're not going to be just killed, they're going to be thrown into the lake of fire right from the time Christ returns. There is a purpose behind that, understanding that these men may have come to the place where they crossed the line. Notice what I just said, they may have. I'm not going to tell you they have, I'm just simply saying they may have. Now, let's read what it says in verse 8. Now then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. So you have the Antichrist, and then you have Christ's return. So we believe Antichrist comes first, sits in this temple, and then Christ comes second, and he destroys him. He kills him. He throws him in the lake of fire at his particular return. So we see that if he calls himself God, who will he point to as the Antichrist? If he calls himself God, who will he point to as the Antichrist? Okay, let's continue to read. Verse 10, with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth. Mark it, underline it, color it, put stars around it. That is the most profound statement that you can look at when it comes to the deception of the time of the end. It means simply that people will not believe the Bible. They will believe a man. They will believe a man with such fervor that he can sit in the temple of God saying that he's God. Notice what it goes on to say. For this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. Now, what is that? Simple. When you reject divine revelation, remember something very important. And that is when you look at the history of this church before it even was a church as we know it, there was a certain approach to authority. And when you look at it after 31 AD, 32, 33 AD, during that period as they began to form into the 100s, 150, up to 300, 350 as a particular universal church, you will find something very interesting. You will find something very interesting. You will find the papal authority is number one. You will find number two, that the writings or the traditions of the fathers are number two. Guess which finds last place? Yeah, you're laughing because you know. The scriptures. The scriptures. So we begin to see that when we look at this particular prophecy, it tells us here that God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned or judged who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So, what does it mean? It means very simply that you have something that does occur at this particular time. Now, let me take you to an article that was written that I think will be very helpful for you in this particular case. We ask the question of what does the universal church say about some things? By its own admission, it bases a definition of the articles of faith on its own interpretation of the scriptures and traditions as explained in the writing of the early church fathers. Let me tell you why. This is from the Council of Trent. You can write this down. Council of Trent, page 145. The history of the Council of Trent. Here's what it says. And then it was approved by all that the traditions should be received of equal authority with the scriptures. They should be of equal authority with the scriptures. Now you say, okay, then that means that the writings and the scriptures are here. Hang on. We have to carry it one step further. There's more to that than that. Any attempt to dispute their interpretation by the use of plain scriptures is greeted, as it was in that time, by the declaration of a cry of heretic and branded anathema. Listen to what it says. This is again from the Council of Trent, the history of the Council of Trent. This is page 152. Here's what it says. The Holy Scripture cannot be expounded against the sense held by the Holy Mother, the Church, not against the common consent of the fathers. So immediately the Council of Trent puts the authority of the man, it puts the authority of the traditions of the fathers in second place, and it puts the Bible in third. Now, what can you do with that? What can you actually do with that? Well, very simply, when you start looking at these different places where they are writing things, you begin to see how they come to the realizations and the understandings that they do. The history of the Council of Trent, I quoted two parts from there for you. I'm going to quote from the Catholic Encyclopedia in a moment. The anti-Nicene fathers, not post-Nicene fathers, but mainly anti-Nicene fathers, and some quotes from prophecy for today. And I will tell you what each one of them are. So let's look at right now something I think very, very important, and that is the definition of simply what we call the Antichrist. This is from Prophecy for Today, the book that I showed you just a few minutes ago, and it also has to do with a quote by a gentleman called Abbot Merlin, and he is one of what we call the dead saints or one of the former fathers in that sense of the word. Here's what he said, as well as the Catholic Encyclopedia. Toward the end of the world, Antichrist will overthrow the Pope and usurp his see. Antichrist will overcome the Pope and usurp his see. Now, what is he saying? He's just simply telling you that it's the reverse of what we believe. When you look at 2 Thessalonians 2, Christ will destroy him at his coming. They're saying it's just the opposite. So we begin to understand how a person can sit in the temple of God saying that he is God and face that particular kind of problem. Because they will not admit the truth, the church believes the Antichrist is the one to unseat the Pope, while every Bible prophecy commissions the true Christ to do the job. Listen to a second one. This one comes, again, from Prophecy for Today, from a lady by the name of Anna Katerina Emmerich. And she died about 1824. This is what she said. Antichrist will fight a successful battle at Megiddo, or Armageddon, in Palestine, after which he will hereafter become Lord of the world. And he goes on to say the following. The kings will send armies to the Holy Land, but the Antichrist will slay them all. So now we begin to see how you have a reversal of prophecies that are written that are not seen by men right now. They're not understood because they sit in the writings. No one ever pulls them out right now because this isn't the time. This isn't the time for those things to happen. Let me take you to a few more quotes. I won't bother you with too many quotes, but I want to read some of them to you. Going on about Antichrist. Antichrist and his army will conquer Rome. He will kill the Pope and will take the throne. The Jews will come from everywhere and accept Antichrist as the Messiah. Again, coming from the book Prophecies for Today. It has 107 pages of the quotes of all of these different people, including some of the fathers, such as we're going to see in a moment, Hippolytus. Let's carry it on. Just another example of what is going to happen. This one comes from another individual from this particular book. It says, after the destruction of Rome, Antichrist will appear and exalt himself above the pagan deities and the Trinity. Now, why do you understand pagan deities? You know what I'm talking about, things that are worshipped. Then you look at the second thing, the Trinity. And it goes on to say, coming to Jerusalem, he will succeed through false preaching, miracles, gifts, terror, aided throughout by the devil. An evil spirit will come out of the air, descending upon his followers. He shall feign a resurrection from the dead, cause rain to fall, perform other wonders, all through the power of the devil, and the Jews will welcome him. So we see these things are all hidden underneath. But when a man who sits in a position where he has the highest authority and the tradition of the fathers come second, where do the scriptures go, folks? Out the door. Out the door. Now, let me take you to a man that I think is very interesting. His name is Hippolytus. He's one of the early church fathers, upon which the Catholic Church actually depends for inspiration and dogma. And you can get your Bible out and you can read what he says and you can read what are said by God in the Bible. These prophecies were made by Hippolytus about 170 AD. And listen to what he says. He begins by saying the following. Believe not the enemy who is to come and be seen. For he is an adversary and a corrupter, son of perdition, and deceives you. For this reason he will kill you and smite them with the sword. Anti-Nicene Fathers, Hippolytus, section 29. You can go get it for yourself. You can read it for yourself. It's going to sit there until such time as it is drawn out. Let me take you to another one. Hippolytus goes on to say, at that time, the whole earth will bewail the life of anguish, and the sea and the air in like manner will bewail it, and the sun too will wail, and the wild beasts together with the fowls will wail. The mountains and hills and trees of the plain will wail on account of the race of man, because all have turned aside from the holy God and obeyed the deceiver, and received the mark of the abominable one, the enemy of God, instead of the quickening cross of the Savior. This is from Hippolytus, Anti-Nicene Fathers, section 33. Again, look it up for yourself. This is not a deception. This is simply a fact of reading from what we see in the writings of these men. Hippolytus, one more time. But again, he's one of the ones that I think is most interesting in this case because he's so well accepted by the church. In the presence of all, he exhibits himself as taken up into the heavens, with trumpets and sounds and mighty shoutings of those who hail him, with indescribable hymns, the heir of darkness himself shining like light, at one time soaring to the heavens and another descending to the earth with great glory, and again charging the demons like angels to execute his behests with much fear and trembling. For he will show forth his demons, brilliant like angels. He will bring in hosts of the incorporable without number. Hippolytus, Anti-Nicene Fathers, section 33. So we begin to see, the importance of looking at all of these things that are occurring. One more from Hippolytus. Again, it gives you from section number 37. That, then the abominable one. I think if this is not blasphemy against the very God of heaven and earth, I don't know what it is. Then the abominable one will send his commands throughout every government by the hand at once of demons and of visible men, who shall say, a mighty king has arisen on the earth. Come you all to worship him. Come you all to see the strength of his kingdom. For behold, he will give you corn. He will bestow on you wine, great riches and lofty honor. For the whole earth and the sea obeys his command. Come you all unto him. Yeah, that's the beginning of the millennium, folks. That's Jesus Christ. And you see what he has done with that. So we recognize, I think, very much what we see occurring at this particular time. One more quote in this particular area. By reason of the scarcity of food, all will go to him and worship him, and he will put his mark on their right hand and on their forehead, that no one may put the sign of the honorable cross upon his forehead with his right hand, but his hand is bound. Again, Hippolytus, section 28, in this particular case. So we see a number of things that are written. They are hidden underneath. I quoted to you four places you can go to read all about that, and I think it becomes an important point to look at. Now, let's look at something else just for a moment. Let's look at the giant rehabilitation program that God says is going to be carried out. In this situation, only those who know God's truth could be expected to really understand what is going on. But I'm going to quote to you from, again, I'm sorry, Hippolytus, because it says, the public service of God shall be extinguished. At that time, silver and gold shall be cast out of the street, and none shall gather them, but all things shall be an offense. And, of course, the public service is the Catholic Mass. It will not be allowed, and man will simply not be able to buy God. Man will simply not be able to buy God. Two more quotes, and I will end it in this particular case. Listen to this delusion. This, again, comes from another individual in prophecy for today, Diosthenes of Luxembourg, and then, of course, Frederick Faber is another individual that I'm going to quote from. Again, you can find that in this particular book. And Antichrist will be an iconoclast against idols, okay? Most of the world will adore him. He will teach that the Christian religion is false. Oh, my. Secondly, the confiscation of Christian property is legal, and that means taking over those areas that they had control of before. Saturday is to be observed instead of Sunday. And he will change the Ten Commandments, that is, restore them back to their original form. That's actually what is going to happen. And all his wonders could not be written in a book. They will be more wonderful than the Old and New Testament. He will read people's minds, raise the dead, reward his followers, punish the rest. And that comes from prophecy from today in that particular book. Last of all, from Frederick William Faber, he died in 1863. He will begin by affecting respect for the law of Moses. Interesting. Why are we going through these things? I think it's very simple. We have to understand that what is happening when you saw the picture on the balcony, when you saw the million people in the Vatican court, when you saw the 2 million people in Brazil, when you saw the millions of people in the United States and other areas of the world, many people were caught up in the fervor of what was going on. We have to understand what is about to befall the world that we live in. The deception, the great deception that I've been talking about. It's sitting underneath. The writings are all there. I quoted to you from four different sections of writing. You can go check it for yourself and understand that I haven't pulled the wool over your eyes today in any manner, shape, or form, because you can go there and find it for yourself. But if we better understand the scriptures which tell us that the nations were angry and men blasphemed the true God and the armies of the earth fought against the true Christ, then perhaps this day for you and I will be the beginning of a better understanding. What a gigantic job we will have in restoring the truth to a deceived world. Truly, Satan the devil has deceived the whole inhabited earth. This season, as we enter into it, trumpets, atonement, tabernacles, last great day, pictures the beginning of re-education. How blessed we are in having the knowledge of God's truth.